Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Today on the show, we'll have a couple of stories from the Wyoming legislature, including a look at coal.
We need to be figuring out how to keep it as viable as possible in the long term until we come up with a better way to raise revenue in the state.
Lawmakers are looking into buying land across southern Wyoming. They say it could lead to a more diversified investment portfolio. Former Wyoming Governor Dave Friedenthal warns against over-optimism, though.
I know that this is kind of like the latest shiny object, but I'd want to be incredibly careful and skeptical about how far you go in.
Plus, a discussion with the new CEO of the Wyoming Business Council. Join us for Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. The Wyoming legislature has been meeting for a couple of weeks now, and it seems very similar to past sessions. There's not going to be tax increases. There's a lot of talk about budget cutting, but hardly any real cuts are happening. This despite the fact that revenue projections are dire. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports that while some want change, change takes time.
Senator Dan Dockstader is a strong fiscal conservative from western Wyoming, and late last year he predicted massive budget cuts to areas like education and throughout most of the state government. As majority floor leader, he has a lot of say over what bills and issues the Senate will debate. He's also a champion for mineral production and has been focused on doing everything it takes to protect the coal industry. Dockstader says he and other Republican leaders want energy to be a key focus this session.
I don't want to see us completely leave that discussion. Renewables are very much a part of what we're working on, but I think it's important that we not give up on that which makes us a state, and that's the extraction taxes, the minerals there. That's what supported the state for so many years. I'm not ready to leave that behind us just yet.
Neither is his counterpart down the hall, House Majority Leader Eric Barlow of Gillette.
I'm not naive about the challenges that are before us, but I'm not. We just don't surrender. We say, what can we do? What can we do that's prudent to at least maintain, one, the jobs, and with the jobs, of course, that revenue is also available.
This also entails spending a lot of money on various types of efforts to capture and make CO2 marketable. House Minority Leader Kathy Connolly was hopeful that the session would bring about some interesting concepts, and she's been a little frustrated that the state is not trying new things.
Why are we spending money chasing something that we have heard over and over again from high-level economists without any political agenda, that that's not what the appetite is in terms of electricity?
So I'm not sure it's a waste of time.
That's Representative Albert Summers, who's a member of the Appropriations Committee from Pinedale. That committee determines what the spending priorities are for the state. When it comes to CO2, Summers is bullish.
You know, even by the climate change projections, at some point we may have to capture carbon out of the atmosphere, right? On Earth, to get done what we want. So I think some of the things we work on at the university and some things in other processes are getting to that.
The reason they care so much about that is because they are looking for new ways for Wyoming to be a leader. Wyoming is facing a major shortfall in future revenue. And in fact, they'd be having problems now if they didn't have $1.5 billion in a reserve account that keeps refilling. Going into the session, many conservatives wanted spending cuts, and one target was education. There are attempts at cutting back some spending there, but there does not seem to be a huge appetite for that in the House. Of course, part of the reason is that Speaker of the House Steve Harshman is a teacher. Sundance Representative Tyler Lindholm says education spending does need to be looked at to a point. For instance, he does not want to do anything to hurt teachers, and he says he's not alone.
Well, I think that's statewide, right? I mean, most of the folks in my area, I've never had anybody come to me and say, Tyler, these teachers are paid too much. That doesn't happen. What I think we do need to look at is the State Department of Education, and the State Board of Education. We need to look at their role. Then we need to look at the basket of goods. We don't want to cut teachers. We don't want to cut our schools. But we do got to find efficiencies.
They also need to find money. Representative Summers says the forecast looks bad.
So our Craig Revenue Estimating Group that looks at all these long-term projections, they're saying it's out there, that we've got a cliff, that Armageddon could hit sometime after 2024.
Which is why Representative Connolly thinks they need to completely rework the state tax structure so that they have a revenue base in the future.
I want a vibrant future, and I'm not seeing it right now.
She says too many discussions have been on holding the line and not taxing. But what's interesting is that despite the projections, there is a little optimism in the air. For instance, Republican leaders and the governor think a plan to purchase land in southern Wyoming will lead to a payday. Senator Dockstader is also excited about some proposals to enhance state investments.
I think that we give that a little bit more time and use our investments to help structure the budget in the future. We have the right man in the office with Governor Gordon who understands investments to line this out for the coming few years.
Dockstader says thoughtful reductions will continue to be necessary, but he admits he's more optimistic than he was 4 months ago. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
In this year's legislative budget session, the percentage of bills related to coal increased by over 300% compared to last year. Over the past year, discussions centered around bills focused on better preparing for coal bankruptcies, helping miners, workers, and recouping taxes from companies, but the majority of legislation now focuses simply on bolstering the industry. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports legislators are now looking to the resource for financial survival.
The House Revenue Committee sat down on an early Wednesday morning to a full audience. The chairman, Dan Zwanitzer, switched seats in order to testify on a bill called Reliable and Dispatchable Low-Carbon Energy Standards.
What we're setting up in this bill is, in some cases, a portfolio standard where a portion of our electricity base comes from coal.
Zwanitzer acknowledges coal demand nationwide is decreasing, but he says maybe that's happening faster than it needs to. Wyoming's chief energy advisor, Randall Luthy, agrees, saying there's room for coal production to be preserved and even grow.
And there's some that say that we must rip off that bandage now and end our use of coal for electricity. And while, again, I say that decline is likely to continue, Wyoming should not be the state to push coal industry off the cliff.
But instead, Luthy says Governor Mark Gordon wants to encourage new uses for coal and extend its life. House Bill 200 is just one of 16 bills introduced this session devoted to doing that, finding new uses, establishing new markets internationally, and heavily encouraging the continued life of power plants that burn it. House Majority Floor Leader and Gillette Representative Eric Barlow says these bills will help the resource and communities that depend on it.
I don't know that we're going to see a renaissance in coal-fired power plants, but maintaining the ones we do have, coupled with some of the carbon capture potentially, you making coal cleaner to use, and then the alternate products thing.
And with all that, create what lawmakers are calling a new normal, with maybe not the same amount of production, but a leveled off version. Riverton Representative David Miller feels confident that can happen because he says renewables alone can't power the U.S.
I think coal has a place going into the future. And, as soon as the tax credits die off, for the renewable energy, coal will be towards the top of the list again.
So you see it stabilizing going forward?
I see it stabilizing.
But in all this hubbub, Representative Zwanitzer says there's something below the surface driving this legislation. While, of course, they look to help communities and jobs, boosting coal is about financial survival. The electricity-producing resource is a primary revenue source for a state that had to pull about $50 million just since last year from its rainy day accounts to help balance the budget. So Zwanitzer says, yeah, it's important to keep coal around.
That's our number one source of income, and we need to be figuring out how to keep it as viable as possible in the long term until we come up with a better way to raise revenue in the state.
And as far as better ways to raise revenue for Wyoming, opinions differ heavily. there's plenty of discussion of cutting services or K-12 education funding, including from the governor's office. But Swanitzer says the other side of the equation, taxes, are tougher for lawmakers to swallow.
We can't raise taxes this session. There's no will to do so. The budget keeps getting worse.
There are various small taxes in discussion, but something that would raise big money like a state income tax, Miller says, is dead on arrival in Wyoming.
Once, you know, if minerals are shut down in Wyoming and our population drops to 150 or 200,000 and we're catering to the tourists and we have all these tourist taxes, but it's still not enough, I could see maybe a state income tax then.
Swanitzer says this session, we're seeing Band-Aids to help the coal industry stay viable, and that he's upset there's no new long-term revenue strategy to take Wyoming into the future. The governor's office has said there does need to be a sober conversation about the future, including Wyoming's tax structure, which relies on coal for 15 to 20% of its state taxes. But House Floor Leader Barlow says it's probably not going to happen this year.
Well, I think it's challenging to have those real frank conversations when the state is sitting on a rainy day fund of $1.7 billion.
Not to mention, there are still strategies to save money, and many hold out hope for coal to rebound or at least stabilize. In an interview, the governor says this session is step one to a long process of getting Wyoming back on track.
We have an urgency to address these issues, but it's not a panic. And in fact, what we need to do is think carefully about how we transition and position our economy going forward.
Meanwhile, lawmakers are eyeing ways to generate more money from renewables in hopes of having it replace lost income from coal revenue. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McCann.
When we come back, a conversation with the new CEO of the Wyoming Business Council. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. Recently, a Laramie man was chosen as the new CEO of the Wyoming Business Council. Josh Durrell has a long history in private business in Laramie, and he's also taught business at the University of Wyoming. Governor Gordon and others have called for a revamping of the Business Council, and Durrell has already started retooling their goals. He tells me a little bit about his history.
The last few weeks have been a bit of a whirlwind, and it's really exciting. And in terms of my background that I bring, it is all private business background. Started out in engineering, but then quickly moved into more business roles with IDES, a small technology company in Laramie, which was later purchased by UL. And then I moved over to Trihydro about 4 years ago and began a technology group within that organization and turned that into product development and software development organization. And so my background really is both in the private business and as well as the entrepreneurial space. And really, I think that's what I bring to the table.
Well, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that using IDES as the one big example. I mean, you were part of something that I know the governor has talked about wanting, is seeing if we could grow some of our existing businesses.
Absolutely. And our, you know, refresh strategic plan really focuses in a big portion of it on our existing businesses and how do we grow those areas, because our core industries are really important to us. And so being able to take those smaller companies and really help them grow is a piece of it. But then also, how do we take our existing industries and show them new markets? Or how do we take them and how do we help them pivot to address new customers or new technologies?
Has that been difficult for a lot of them, is finding those new markets?
I think it has been. Traditionally, it's a challenging thing, right? Because you, if you're used to working in a certain industry, you know that industry really well. And I think that the challenges come in trying to address a new industry and really understand some of the business tools that are available to address that new customer base and also seek it out.
Yeah, one of the things also I wanted to ask you about is you have some of these folks that have worked in Wyoming, and that is their target audience, to use something that we use in broadcasting, that they're going after folks here. Getting them beyond the borders and using technology with your background, I'm wondering if that's something you can help folks with as well.
I hope so, and I know that the world is getting smaller because of technology, and it's allowing us to work where we want to work and also serve customers where we may not have been able to before. I really hope that that's something I can bring. I know many examples around the state of companies that are addressing markets that aren't close to home, and so helping others around the state understand those and perhaps even be helped by them and leverage their expertise and experience is important.
Josh Durrell visiting with us. He's the CEO of the Wyoming Business Council, very new on the job these days. One of the things that we talk so much about in this state is finding jobs for young people, trying to keep our young people. I've seen a lot of people take cracks at this. Being that you're someone who's actually taught young people and maybe have actually had a reasonable conversation with a couple of them, what do you think we need to do?
That's a tough one, and it's a big challenge that we want to address, because, you know, I mean, people call it brain drain, and they worry that their children won't have an opportunity back in Wyoming, and you know, we do want to make those opportunities available. And one of the things that I've found with young people, and it does change over the generations, is that they are much more concerned with they're concerned with lifestyle. They're concerned with being able to do the things that they want to do, but also they want experiences that can be a little bit different. And I think that the technology that we have in the state, as well as the ability for people to work for companies and maybe work remotely, is important. But really, you know, I would like to keep every University of Wyoming student here, but on some hands, that's not that great of a thing either. Having them leave and go away and get some great experience in a larger company or get experience in another area really can provide some diversity to our state as well when they come back. And so my goal is to provide opportunities so that it's easier for them to come back, because we know some will leave, right? Mm-hmm. When you're 18 or 22, you want to leave the state, you want to go do something new. We want to be able to provide those opportunities as they come back.
You do hear, though, all the time that I want to be in this particular field or technology, mm-hmm. and a lot of it is technology-based things to get them here. What do we need to do to get to that point where there are some attractive options for them?
Yeah, we're working on that, and some of the areas that we're looking at in terms of advanced manufacturing, technology, really bringing those into areas that can support them, and trying to build some clusters almost, you know, where we don't have just one company in a town that is supporting that technology growth, but really try to bring in 3, 4, 5, because then you have a cluster and you can really kind of get, and this is, it's an overused word, but you can get a bit of an ecosystem of technology companies, and that helps them grow. And so I think there are areas around the state where we've been able to develop those, and we'll continue to do those, both in advanced manufacturing as well as technology.
For whatever reason, Josh, I know a lot of young entrepreneurs and old entrepreneurs, for that matter, and they all complain. But boy, there is just not enough startup money. There's not enough backing. Do you agree with them? Is there things we can do here?
I don't know if there's not enough. But I think that the access to it could be improved. And so I do believe, based on some of the entrepreneurs that you and I both probably know, that it's not impossible to get it, but you've got to know the right channels. I believe that there are a number of institutions and individuals that have startup money and that want to invest in companies and ideas in Wyoming. I think one of the roles that the Wyoming Business Council can play is in assisting that connection, because there is a great number of people who want to help and develop Wyoming's, you know, economy, and they've done very well in their lives and they want to give back. And so I think they're there. I don't think that it's not there. I think that it just hasn't been connected very well. And that's something that we really want to improve.
Josh, I haven't had a chance to ask you everything that you'd like to do, but what did we miss that you would like to mention?
Well, I think, you know, one of the keys for us is to make sure that with this new strategic refresh, that we help people understand how they can be involved, how the local economic development organizations, as well as our partners at the University of Wyoming and throughout the state, our team, can really make sure that we're all behind the strategic plan and working with businesses. And so I guess if I could kind of plug the business council a little bit, it's to let everyone know that we're going to get out there. We're going to begin to talk with businesses, the local economic development organizations, and really help to expand the strategic plan to include all of the stakeholders. And it's important to me because I really feel like Wyoming's is a small state in terms of population, but we have a great number of people who want to be involved and want to help. And I think that alignment is where we really want to take this next step.
Josh, I know we'll have a lot of time to talk to you down the road on a variety of topics. Josh Durrell, welcome to this job. He's the new CEO of the Wyoming Business Council. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
When we come back, a conversation regarding Wyoming's plan to buy a lot of land with former Governor Dave Freudenthal. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. Governor Mark Gordon recently announced that Wyoming is looking to make a major new investment, buying 1 million acres of land across southern Wyoming and through surrounding states. Occidental Petroleum is looking to sell its checkerboard plots after recently acquiring them. Union Pacific originally had the rights. State leadership believes that the purchase could help boost and diversify Wyoming's investment portfolio for years to come. Here's the governor.
There's a real opportunity here that is maybe a once-in-a-lifetime kind of opportunity.
State leaders go on to mention that the land could provide new opportunities in energy development, recreation, grazing, and land swaps. But so far, there's little concrete information about the deal. Speaker of the House Steve Harshman said they expect questions.
Should government buy land like this? I think, and fair enough, is it a good investment? Is it a good use of our dollars? All these questions are going to be out there, and we're going to have to figure it out as we go.
Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with former Governor Dave Freudenthal about the magnitude of unknowns, the risk of the purchase, and prudence of it in what's been a difficult financial period for Wyoming.
It sort of intuitively sounds like a good idea to diversify the state's investment portfolio, but it's like everything else, the devil's in the detail. What's the price? Does it meet any kind of legitimate investment threshold in terms of the projected income? And the level of uncertainty, given that the revenue source is primarily going to be mineral development, and mineral development has not been, other than in kind of the Laramie County portion of the UP Strip, is not proving terribly encouraging, particularly out in the southwest in terms of the number of rigs that are operating in that. So I think the state has a difficult problem confronting it, which is how do you value it? It's too bad we couldn't take advantage of a lot of the other energy companies who've looked at the properties and decided not to buy them and to get a better understanding of Oxy's interest in selling them. Most of this is going to come down to price, but there's also, I think, a legitimate question about whether the government wants to be managing more lands than it already does. State manages about 3.6 million acres that came to us at the time of statehood. Public is, and I think legitimately so, kind of mixed on whether the state's a successful manager of the land. I know that this is kind of like the latest shiny object, but I'd want to be incredibly careful and skeptical about how far you go in. We should do, and I assume they are, doing fairly serious diligence. We should be nervous about obligating funds that may be needed to balance the budget going forward. As you can tell, the legislature is by and large kicking the can down the road on revenues, which is a pretty typical Wyoming approach. And so I get the notion that you want to diversify the state's investment portfolio. But if the return on the diversification is not sufficient to justify it, we need to be careful, because we are dependent on these investments for going forward.
From folks who really like the idea, there's discussion about what a unique opportunity it is to be able to buy so much land at one time. Would that be attractive?
Absolutely. I mean, the idea of being able to deal with the mess that the checkerboard has always been for everybody is really attractive. The question is, at what price and what are you giving up? I mean, the opportunity cost of taking money that's currently invested and getting a yield, placing it into this more diversified portfolio, has to be calculated, and it has to be calculated in terms of the risk. I mean, is it logical for the state to assume a risk that the private sector doesn't want to accept and make the purchase? It may be if the price is right. If the price is significantly discounted, that makes sense. And then you have to figure out, what are our administrative costs? I mean, what is it it's going to cost us to administer this land? You know, the bill provides for payment of local taxes, as it should, if they're taken off the tax roll. I mean, there's a lot of unanswered questions, yet there's this attraction to the notion of, most everybody here, we are the product of migration from Europe, and most of our forefathers came to this country with the idea that having land is a really important thing. I mean, that's who we are. We believe in that. And so you can believe in that relative to the state. But this legislation is a huge piece of trust me. It authorizes people to act without, near as I can tell, I don't see a requirement that it come back to the legislature. In fact, it looks to me like it appropriates an undefined sum of money to be used at the discretion of the elected officials within the context of the prudent investor rule.
The last piece would just be what the average person would think and why they would care if they were a Wyomingite worried about the sustainability of their state's budget.
You know, I'm kind of in that average person category at this stage, and I just wonder about the full assessment of the risk and whether or not, I want to make sure we don't get caught up in this sort of optimism of, wouldn't it be great to own this land, and end up either paying more than it's worth or end up underestimating the problems we're going to have going forward and expenses in terms of managing it. I mean, there's a reason people invest in other options, whether it's stock market or bonds or whatever it is. And this investment needs to be compared to that relative to the income that it generates for the state.
Any other pieces to keep in mind?
I just hope that somebody's doing really serious diligence and number crunching, because just like this session, they're drawn down on those reserves. And if those reserves get transferred into a hard asset, the ability to draw down on those reserves to fund the ongoing operation of government disappears.
Well, that's Wyoming's former Governor David Friedenthal. Thanks for talking.
You bet.
At the end of 2019, the Bureau of Land Management leased out more than 37,000 acres of land in northern Park County for potential oil and gas drilling. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports some are alarmed about the recent spike in land available for oil and gas and what that means for the area's unique wildlife.
I've just rolled onto Ken and Kathy Lichtendahl's property in Clark. Clark is north of Cody and just south of the Montana border, nestled right on the edge of the Shoshone National Forest, which borders Yellowstone National Park. Kathy and Ken have lived here for over 25 years. They're worried about the elk that winter nearby and how new energy development will affect them. Apparently, it's not that hard to find them.
Let's go see the elk. Now, it's a little bit of a hike.
So we head out and are soon overlooking a valley dotted with elk. Kathy points to a parcel of land that could see oil and gas development soon. She's particularly worried about its impacts.
That's where the elk go to calve. There's a golden eagle nest right over there in that cliff that has been active for years and years and years and years. There's coyote, there's mule deer, there's pronghorn.
For the Lichtendahls, they're not opposed to oil and gas, but they want it done responsibly.
It just seems like there should be a way to not offer quite so much land up for leasing right in the middle of such important habitat.
In Wyoming, it's a lot more common to see development in the northeast part of the state, not here. But as of 2 years ago, it started to pick up in this area with a particularly sensitive ecosystem. People like the Lichtendahls just want to make sure the agency overseeing the process are ensuring the protection of wildlife. The BLM says they are doing that. They do a ton of analysis that includes reports submitted by the Wyoming Game and Fish, who determined the only regulation for these parcels was related to the active raptor nest, saying no surface use is allowed within 1/4 of a mile of an active nest. Impacts to the elk habitat are not addressed, says Amanda Withroder. She's with Wyoming Game and Fish.
When we took a look at those parcels and overlaid them with our wildlife layers, that was not something that we flagged as being an issue.
The BLM says lack of consideration around certain wildlife doesn't come from nowhere. There are many steps in the environmental review process. If there are new concerns raised by the public or another agency, they will consider it in the permit application to actually drill, says Courtney Whiteman.
We'll also check to see if, like, anything has changed or there's new considerations or if there's any other kind of restrictions or guidelines we need to put on that proposed development.
The Lichtendahls hope that the BLM will consider the elk herd in the permit application process, but it's hard for the Clark community to trust the BLM and developers because of a well spill in the area back in 2006. It contaminated the river. Ken Lichtendahl again.
If we learn from it, it has a high probability it'll turn out well in the future. If we don't, we'll see more and more. So I think we need to use history and learn. I think BLM wants to do it right.
In the end, it comes down to how much the developers will actually follow those best practices set by the BLM. The parcels in question for the Lichtendahls have been leased to two small developers, so only time can tell what will happen. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Gadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
There are an estimated 6,000 big game animals killed by vehicle collisions each year in the state. The Wyoming Game and Fish Department and groups have been trying to find ways to reduce that number for years. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with Game and Fish's Deputy Director, Angie Bruce, to talk about the department's new initiative and what it means for animals and drivers in the state.
It's called Wildlife Crossings, keeping wildlife and drivers on the go. We rolled out this initiative as part of a governor's signing of his first Migration Corridor Executive Order. And part of that initiative is communicating the importance of it, but then also challenging the public to act as well. And so the governor came out with a 2020 challenge, and that is the goal of reaching 2020 license plates by the end of the year. And the conservation license plates were put into place by legislators 2 years ago that allow you to purchase a license plate where the majority of the funds go to this initiative and go to future projects that will benefit wildlife and roadways.
What are kind of the major things that you'll be focusing on through this? Like, are there specific projects that'll be coming off of this?
The department has worked very closely with the Department of Transportation on our top statewide projects. We have identified the Dry Piney Project, which is part of Highway 189. It's one of the highest collision areas in the state for mule deer. And the project will install 7 to 8 underpasses that will allow for safe crossing passage under Highway 189 in a 28-mile stretch of the highway. And we're predicting that through that effort, the collisions will go down 80 to 90% once those underpasses are built.
And what are some of the other high priority places or projects?
The state does have 240 statewide projects identified. Those can be found on our website. There are all sorts of different projects at different scales. We've also taken a close look at those 240 and come up with a top list of statewide large projects, just around 40 for those. In addition, we've also looked at the feasibility of those top 40 and come up with the top 10 to kind of focus and concentrate our fundraising efforts around.
What are some of the options that Game and Fish or the Department of Transportation can use to lessen the accidents that happen?
There are a suite of possible solutions. We do know that some solutions can be as effective as 80 to 90% in some stretches. For instance, providing safe passage for big game, either, like I talked about earlier, under the highway or with an overpass over the highway. But we also know that those are not an option everywhere due to various reasons, maybe geographic reasons. And so we look at all the tools in the toolbox, and different things that we do is different fencing options. In some cases along Interstate 80, there's very high fences, about 6 foot high, that actually produce a barrier. And in this case, when we have those, what I would call blockage fences, they keep the big game from entering the highway, which is a very good safety measure for motorists. But that what they do as well is they block the deer, antelope, and other big game from getting to other habitats. And so it limits their ability to move around. So sometimes those fences can work, and sometimes they're not an option.
And you've mentioned a little bit about increasing public involvement or public awareness. Can you explain exactly what you mean by that?
You know, some of these solutions that I've been talking about are really putting the onus on the wildlife. So if we can move the wildlife safely across the highway. But part of that education back on the citizens of Wyoming and those motorists who cross Wyoming on our highways is making them aware of where these hotspots or priority areas are, where there is lots of big game movement, especially at certain times of the year or certain times of the day. And so it's putting the onus back on the driver to be more cautious, maybe slow down in this area, and educate them on the importance of doing that and how they can have an impact, not only for wildlife, but on their safety as well. Another one back that we talk about how we can engage them, again, is through the purchase of a conservation license plate. Not only is it contributing to this effort, but what I have noticed from my own license plate is I get a lot of people looking at it and asking about it. So it brings awareness to the initiative by having these plates out there invisible.
Angie Bruce is the Deputy Director of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. Thank you, Angie, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Anytime.
When we come back, a visit to a sweat lodge and how it's being used to help veterans. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is tweaking its treatment options in an effort to be more holistic. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler says a program at the Sheridan VA is making space for practices that come from traditions from regional Native American tribes.
On the eastern edge of the Sheridan VA campus sits a quiet view over northern Sheridan. In the winter, the grass is dead and the mud is thick when there isn't snow covering it. And along the path, there are signs marking a sacred circle. Derek Schultz is a chaplain at the facility.
And it's that area where Native American ceremonies and opportunities are provided, working through a host of different tribes to come and provide this very important, very traditional practice that brings a lot of healing and a lot of purpose and meaning in so many of our veterans' lives.
There's a teepee for talking circles, painted rocks forming a medicine wheel, and a turtle shell-shaped hut with a small fireplace made of cement blocks. That's the site of the sweat lodge ceremonies the VA is now hosting at its main campus. For more than a decade, a VA outpatient clinic has been holding these traditional ceremonies in Fort Washakie. But Schultz says Native American veterans at the Sheridan campus would come to him looking for guidance.
And so it became important to say, well, how do we then engage with that and help you deepen that and strengthen that since it is so meaningful to you?
Stephen Seminole is Northern Arapaho and Northern Cheyenne. He's also a veteran himself who is assisting and guiding sweats with the VA.
Well, sweat is to actually go in there and pray for yourself, pray for your loved one, and for healing. It is a ceremony.
Sweat lodges are historically connected to many Plains tribes. For the ceremony, rocks are heated by a fire. Then the people participating head into the sweat lodge and sit in a circle along the walls of the lodge. Inside, the structure is supported with red willow branches that were brought from the Wind River Reservation. The rocks themselves are the healing force and are brought in from the fire and placed in a pit in the center of the structure. Heat then fills the space. A cedar powder is sprinkled on the rocks. Each member takes a drink of water from a ladle. Then the door is closed and water is added to the rocks. The elders lead songs of prayer and healing and encourage others to also sing, pray, and let out what is weighing on them.
It's like you're being reborn again, you know, like washing away your sins.
And after about 20 minutes, the door is open for fresh air and a round is complete. There are usually four rounds, building with intensity from the heat and emotions. Seminole says the ceremony is about purification.
Throughout the day or your past experiences, maybe you can't express it to anybody, but when you go in there, you can express it right there. Even though you don't say it out loud, you can just pray. You want to be healed from this, whatever is weighing on me, you know. And I go out that door and open up that door when we're done with the four rounds, and I'm going to be better. I'm going to look at life better.
He says this ceremony and other methods of healing are a way of life for his tribe and many others. But the program is also available to non-Native veterans. Seminole says the experience can be beneficial to anyone as long as they are open to it.
You got to be sincere about these things, and also you got to be open-minded of what's taking place. We've been doing this for a long time through our culture, you know, and helping people.
One of those non-Native American veterans is Joanne Sims, who has complex post-traumatic stress disorder. She says it was an honor to be a part of it, and it deeply impacted her.
And in this process, I was able to feel my respect for myself and my honor. And this was a very moving ritual that I went through, to not just leave the past in the past, but to move forward in new strength and power.
The VA chaplain, Derek Schultz, says he has been working on the Native American program for almost 10 years. But it's only in the past couple of years that the Sheridan VA built its own sweat lodge and started hosting sweats with more consistency. Schultz says the program is part of the VA's whole health model.
Spirituality is one of the components of a human being. And so the sweat lodge, the Native American program, the smudging, and those elements all tie very well in with the whole health model. And so that whenever they depart from our facility, that they are not focused as much on their past, but they learn the very valuable lessons from it. And so they can move forward with that gained knowledge and gained insight to live differently in a way that's meaningful and, again, purposeful to them.
Each tribe that practices sweats holds them in a different way. So the Sheridan VA works with the region's Veterans Integrated Service Network and the Helena Indian Alliance to find elders from regional tribes to come share their traditions. Schultz says as they move forward, the Sheridan campus wants to hold more sweats for veterans and expand on the program to include more local VA clinics in their coverage area. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Sheridan.
This month marks the 100th anniversary of the Cody Country Chamber of Commerce, or the Cody Club, as it was known until 1970. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska spoke with Jeremy Johnston, historian at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, and Tina Hobel-Henrich, the president of the Cody Country Chamber of Commerce, on how the club began. Johnston says it started with the town's founders, George Beck and Buffalo Bill Cody, trying to attract people to the area.
And it started out as a sportsman organization. And Beck and Cody both realized that tourism, hunting, was going to be important to the future economy. And so this hunting club was set up intending to bring in some high-profile individuals who could go hunting. They reached out to General Nelson Miles. He came out here for a hunting trip, one of the first Cody Club hunting trips. They also tried to get Theodore Roosevelt. Unfortunately, Theodore Roosevelt went to the South on a bear hunt instead, which is fortunate for the United States because that's the trip that gave us the famous teddy bear. But for Cody, it meant that Theodore Roosevelt never did visit this region. And then, of course, the biggest accomplishment was bringing in the Prince of Monaco in 1913 for a hunting trip. And again, all of this really brings attention to our close connection to Yellowstone National Park, the transportation route that was developing from Cody to the east entrance, and the big game hunting opportunities that were here.
So basically, Beck decided to create the Cody Club, which was a sportsman club, to try to bring people or like to give bring a like awareness of Cody, and then maybe that would help people come and live here.
It was mainly a hunting organization to begin with, and then it went through fits and starts until it was officially incorporated.
Well, it became an official organization early in its creation and in its existence. The concept was not really that it would be a chamber of commerce. I don't really know that chambers of commerce were a thing then. But what happened is, as you know, these group of like-minded individuals would come together, it became aware that they were also the group that was concerned with the issues or the concerns or the struggles that the citizens of Cody were facing. And so the focus turned away from hunting and really more inclusive of all of the challenges of the region. And it wasn't until the 1970s that the Cody Club actually became the Cody Country Chamber of Commerce. But it functioned as a chamber of commerce even before then, really in scope and in purpose.
It was at first trying to attract sportsmen out to Cody, and then it kept people involved in the community. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think it really engaged businesses because of the tie to tourism. It's a pretty short leap from what's good for business is good for all of us, and what's good for business in Cody, even then, was tourism.
Basically, the main idea was to bring an economy boost, right, to the area.
Exactly. And Beck and Cody were really good at diversifying the economy and investing in the local oil fields. We mentioned the tourism, but also transportation and building a lot of the institutions that are here in the community today, raising money and funds to build the early Buffalo Bill Museum that became the Buffalo Bill Center of the West. A lot of contributions, and even the airport. I mean, they were very instrumental in getting the airport started.
Well, and even before the airport, it was just maximizing on the awareness and increasing awareness of the East Gate, you know, as a way to the nation's first national park.
And was there ever like a full transition from like, okay, we're not a sportsman club anymore, but we are now the Chamber of Commerce?
Before it was called a Chamber of Commerce, I think that transition took place about the time that this Cody Club luncheon started. So in the 1920s, I think the scope really changed from really an exclusive sportsman's club to a club of citizens who were concerned with Cody.
Really, that's a critical time period for the town of Cody.
The 1920s?
Because Buffalo Bill had passed away in 1917, so you lose your celebrity spokesperson. Mm. That individual is now gone. And so the Cody Club really did a good job in filling that void and getting out there and publicizing what's available here. Tremendous, and they still do a tremendous job of marketing this community to developers, to potential visitors, to people who just want a nice place to live.
And so you mentioned the Cody's luncheon, the Cody Club's luncheon. So if you can kind of tell me
what
that is.
Agnes Chamberlain hosted the very first Cody Club luncheon. So the Cody Club luncheon started 100 years ago today, February 11th, the first lunch was at the Chamberlain Inn. But I think that the Cody Club luncheon itself served a purpose. You know, that truly is how people networked and how they communicated before modern communication existed. I mean, in order to know what your neighbors were doing or to connect with businesses and find out what you were doing, it was really important to get in the same room. And so the Cody Club Luncheon facilitated that.
Is this a normal way for the Chamber of Commerce to be developed, or is this kind of unique that it came from a sportsman club?
I would have to say that the Cody Club probably was a little more aggressive and better connected than a lot of the other Chamber of Commerce as you see in other communities. I mean, those connections to the East that Beck and Cody had established and continuing those connections really brought a lot of investment into this area.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can hear the entire show again or find individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. All you have to do is just click on Open Spaces. Going through that site, you can also link to our podcast or find old programs, and a rater is our web editor.
Don't forget, you can support this show and our Wyoming news coverage with a pledge on that website.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.